Next up on This Week in Law, we're going to talk about Google and its new search algorithm, which takes into account copyright violations. We're going to talk about Hulu and challenging the Video Privacy Protection Act. Other policy, privacy, and entertainment-related issues with Eric Goldman, John Stevenson, and Evan Brown. Next up on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 175, recorded August 17, 2012. They're among the super soakers. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter the promo code TWIL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you've tuned in for This Week in Law. We're thrilled to have you because we have a great panel here today. Really an amazing panel of folks to talk about the latest and greatest in technology law. Returning back to the show is our never not awesome Professor Eric Goldman. Hello, Eric.
Hello, how are you?
Doing great. Great to have you back on TWIL.
Glad to be here.
I was watching John Stewart the other night and he had Brian Williams on, and I feel like John Stewart having Brian Williams on whenever you come on, just, you know, it's a great guest for him. He knows he's just going to have a wonderful time when Brian comes on. So that's how we feel about you.
Whenever I see John Stewart, I think of you.
There we go. I'm not sure what to make of that exactly, but we'll welcome our next guest, who is another John Stevenson from Washington, D.C., and the organization ALEC. Hello, John.
Hello, Denise, and hello, everyone. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, John is the Director of Communication and Technology for ALEC, which stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council. And we'll talk a bit more about them later on in the show and pick your brain on some of the policy issues that you're paying attention to, John.
Looking forward to it.
Okay. And also joining us is Evan Brown from Chicago. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. How's it going? Happy Friday to ya.
Great to see you. Happy Friday to you.
Yes, good to see you.
All right, so we've got bunches of stuff to talk about, and since it's a long, hot summer and we're all in need of a little entertainment, let's start things off in Hollywood. And the reason that I included this next story in our Hollywood section of the show is because there have been some mixed responses from Hollywood to Google's decision to change its search algorithm so that sites that receive a large number of valid takedown notices, we can get into what they might mean by that or how that might be determined, are going to be weighted less in search results. So the goal here per the Google search blog is that if you are searching for something and it's available on a site that's, you know, mostly a piracy-oriented site, a site where its business model is along the lines of what the Supreme Court talked about in the Grokster case, where they're capitalizing on the public's desire to obtain things illegally, then they're going to get weighted less in search results. And the RIAA and MPAA have come out and said, you know, bravo, Google, but let's see more of this. And Professor Goldman, you have a great column and some commentary in Forbes about all this, where you raised something that I really hadn't thought of before. And that is, you know, it's interesting that Google took such a strong stance against SOPA, but you could look at this as a way of voluntarily implementing a lot of the controls that SOPA had in mind. Can you expand on that for us?
Well, first of all, I've been trying to track different ways that the proposals in SOPA are being reintroduced or pursued separately from the legislative process. And there's a long list of activity taking place. I wrote a lengthy blog post explaining all the different ways that the SOPA proposals are coming back in different forms. In this particular case, Google is applying site-wide reputation to all the items of content it indexes from a user-generated content site. What that means is that whether the item that is on a user-generated content site is legitimate or illegitimate, it's going to be equally downgraded if Google applies this site-wide reputation score to the site. What that means then is that legitimate items or content are going to be degraded in their visibility, even though there was never a takedown notice sent on those, and even though they're completely legitimate. And that's exactly one of the many concerns we had about SOPA, is that SOPA was attacking websites over concerns about individual items of content. And that's a mismatch in the remedy and the problem. If the problem is items of infringing content, taking down the legitimate items is not kosher, not cool. And that's exactly what Google is going to be doing with its revamped algorithm.
Evan, the EFF is concerned that the takedown notice process is broken and that there is a lot of illegitimate activity in that arena where people are either filing a takedown notice because they want information from the recipient or because they have some axe to grind with the recipient, and that there's not enough control over making sure that, as Google has said in its public statement on this, that a takedown notice is in fact valid. How do you feel about that?
Well, you're right. It puts our attention front and center on what it means for it to be a valid takedown notice. And Google doesn't go into any explanation as to what a valid takedown notice means when it made this announcement. I trust that what it means is that it comports with all the elements that it has to have, whether that standard looked to the actual language of Section 512 of the DMCA to say that, you know, all the elements are met, all the things that need to be in a takedown notice are there, or perhaps equivalently meets all the standards that that the Google's automated reporting system will require in order for it to actually make its way through. I mean, one interesting statistic that's come up in this discussion, I think this was actually in Google's blog post announcing this changes, this tweaks to its algorithm, was that I had to read this twice to make sure that it was right. They said they process more takedown requests every day now than what they did in the whole year of 2009. Did I read that right? I mean, if that's the case, I mean, it's just staggering. Mm-hmm. The first of all, that's a staggering volume of takedown requests that Google has to process, and moreover, it's what's even more staggering is the extent to which it has increased. Most obviously because it's Google has made it much easier to report content violations like this. So we're fooling ourselves if we think Google is going to give any meaningful actual human thought to what constitutes a valid takedown request. It's going to be something that has to be programmed into the system for Google to make the determination of whether or not a particular takedown request is valid. So in as much as it's left up to computational means to figure that out, it's frightening. I guess it would still be frightening even if it were actually humans sitting there determining which ones are valid. But in any event, there is cause for concern that that there could be some gaming of the system, some abuses here, takedown notices being counted against a subscriber, user of the system. That truly aren't valid. There definitely is a risk of some abuse there. That's for sure.
Yeah, you do have that right. In fact, they say not only are they processing more every day than they did in all of 2009, but more than 4.3 million URLs in the last 30 days alone, and that's all from their transparency report. John, part of this strikes me from a policy maker or observer's standpoint as potentially a positive thing, because Obviously, SOPA was near and dear to the hearts of the entertainment industry, but a badly implemented plan for accomplishing some of their goals. So how do you feel about a private entity like Google deciding, well, we're going to take some further steps on our own to make sure that those content holders and rights holders are happier?
Well, in my view, I think, and I think a lot of policymakers would look at this as definitely a positive development for some of the reasons that Professor Goldman and Evan highlighted. It's very difficult to determine what might be infringing, what might be perfectly legal, and having new tools to address that would be very helpful. It's also in Google's wheelhouse, I think, to use a lot of data. And as Evan and you pointed out, there's a lot of data coming in about these takedown requests, where they're coming from, who they're targeted at, what are the infringing sites and content. So Google, being a company that uses a lot of data in its products to improve its services, I think it only makes sense to integrate that and test it. I think Evan has raised some good points that, you know, there could be some errors in this, may require some vigilance, but overall, I think this is a positive development. And I think policymakers, particularly the ones who I've worked with at the state level, at the federal level, in the regulatory world, certainly like it to see when a private sector company, when it has a problem involving its business or its products and services, when that company tries to effect a solution on its own rather than the heavy hand of government or the hasty response from government.
Eric, you wrote in your Forbes piece that this could be of concern for very legitimate sites, or at least sites seeking legitimacy, but maybe on the edge of where copyright law has gone before, such as Pinterest. And Danny Sullivan has done a little further pushing into this to inquire of Google, well, what are you going to do about YouTube? What are you going to do about other popular sites that get lots and lots of takedown requests, but have lots and lots of legitimate content material as well? And Google has given Danny sort of an amorphous answer that, well, we're going to take care of that. You know, we're going to make sure that those sites that we think are legitimate are not going to be severely impacted by our new regime. Does this give you any comfort?
We operate without transparency into Google's algorithm. And I'm okay with that normally. I'm looking for relevant results as long as Google delivers that. I'm not super concerned about what goes on under the hood. There are people who would disagree with that, but that's that. I'm okay with it personally. The devil is definitely in the details on this particular implementation because Google's response to Danny Sullivan basically said there's going to be a bunch of big players, which I interpret as incumbents, and we'll grandfather in those incumbents. But the new startups, you know, they haven't had a chance to earn our trust yet, so they could get treated differently. And I'd like to know more about that, which Google isn't likely to tell us. But one way of interpreting that is that, sure, the sites that have already gotten through the various hurdles to building a business are going to be okay, but the new entrants aren't. And that actually could raise its own set of concerns, which I did address in my Forbes piece.
Right. I mean, we come down to kind of the age-old question raised by the Betamax case, you know, that certainly there can be infringing uses made of various platforms, but substantial non-infringing uses seem to indicate legitimacy, and we want to be able to foster that and innovation. And, you know, I personally wonder how an algorithm is going to figure all of that out, but I guess we have to wait and see how it does play out. So
Hey, Denise.
Go ahead. Yes.
Just one more point on this. Regarding the false positives problem of the takedown notices, how Google's going to determine that a notice is valid. We actually have at least two checkpoints in the statute designed to correct mistaken takedown notices. One is 17 USC 512F that creates a cause of action for sending bogus takedown notices. And the other is 17 USC 512G, which allows users to counter-notify the website that, in fact, their activity is legitimate. With respect to 512F, the case law has basically eviscerated the statute. We have only one successful judicial finding of a 512F violation in the last 15 years. And with respect to 512G, Google does honor putback notices or counter notifications, but that depends on a site realizing that it got the penalty in the first place. And that may not be easy for sites to determine. It's not clear how someone will learn that they got downgraded such that they should send some kind of counter notifications back to combat the takedown notices being sent against them. So part of the problem with Google's move is that we had these statutory checkpoints or safeguards built in to prevent takedown abuse, and it's not clear that those safeguards will help in this situation.
Well, doesn't the statute, doesn't Section 512 require that the provider, in this case Google, notify its user that it's been the subject of infringing content? Or, I mean, is your concern with like search results being taken out rather than other hosted content like on Blogger or Google Plus or something like that? I mean, I was wondering, you know, whose problem is it really if there's difficulty in notifying the subscriber, if it's because of the subscriber having provided bogus content or bogus contact information? That would be the user / subscriber's problem, not the intermediary's problem.
It's the takedown from search results, which Google, I don't know if they even try to notify people when they take down their search results. They just put the little legend in their search results saying this has been affected by takedown notices. Maybe they're planning to do more than that, but I'm not aware of it. But even if they did that, then the next step would be to tell someone, not only have we removed your specific search results, but now we've applied a site-wide penalty against you. And I haven't heard Google say that it's going to notify people about that either. Google is a little bit of a black box of information that way. People would have to do a very extensive monitoring of Google's activities to figure out that Google's tagged them. And frankly, just thinking about my own blog, I don't even know how I would start to parameterize that. I'm not going to sit there every day and check and see if someone sent takedown notices against my indexing in Google.
Eric, did you see the Next Web article about a blogger named Girl Writes What, who had received a takedown notice? And it raises the question, if she were to file a counter notice and, you know, attempt to combat this, it seems like she was attempting to remain anonymous online and that she suspected that the takedown notices were not actually aimed at any copyright issues with her content, but at getting at her legitimate identity. And I think all of this resolved itself in a way that was okay with her. The notices were withdrawn and it never really came push to shove. But do you see that as a problem in the current notice counter notice system?
I'm not familiar with that particular case. And we're back to this issue of what constitutes a valid notice and how Google's going to know. Are they going to do some kind of manual review or other type of intelligent review to tell that a takedown notice, in fact, is illegitimate because it covered non-copyright concerns? Google, I'm pretty sure, is aware of that problem, but we don't know how they're going to fix it. So the fact they know about the problem that takedown notices are used for non-copyright concerns is good. But it's not clear how aggressively they're going to be pushing back on that. Again, remember, it's not just the takedown of the individual search results. It's the overall site-wide penalty that's going to be applied. So one possibility is that Google would still count takedown notices against the site-wide penalty if they're unsure as opposed to if they have confirmed the validity of the statement. And that's something we won't know exactly how they're computing validity, but it would make a potentially big difference.
Yep, I agree. And this is going to be a super interesting thing to watch unfold and see how it changes search results and potentially sites that have legitimate business models and those that are more on the edges of what we would consider the right side of the law. Let's move on to another story in the realm of Hollywood and entertainment that I found interesting enough to raise because I remember, Evan, when we covered the Joe Walsh versus Joe Walsh issue over use of campaign music by, I think it was a congressional candidate named Joe Walsh, who the musician Joe Walsh was not happy about the appearance of one of his tunes in some sort of campaign activity. And lawyer Peter Paterno in Hollywood sent one of the all-time great cease and desist letters that we had much fun looking at in the show because of its very tongue-in-cheek and sort of patronizing, if you will, tone, but, you know, raising very serious issues about copyright law and what should and should not be done with an artist's works. So that was a couple of years ago now, I believe, and hitting the headlines this week has been the band Silver Sun Pickups doing something similar to Mitt Romney, deciding that one of their songs, which was called Panic Switch, had been played at a Romney event. Romney's campaign came back and said, number one, we have a license to play these things. Number two, it was inadvertent. It was not, you know, part of our campaign activities. It was just something playing in the background. So, you know, leave us alone, but we're not going to play it again. But the interesting little twist on this is the Peter Paterno letter has raised its head again as Eric Gardner discovered or you know, sussed out over at the Hollywood Reporter, Esquire. Did you take a look at this? And are you surprised at what unfolded here? Why don't you follow up and tell folks about it a bit more?
Well, is this when that there's claiming there actually been some plagiarism of the letter that was sent to the Romney campaign, right?
Yes.
Yeah. No,
the Peter Paterno letter, Eric put sort of side by side with the letter sent to the Romney campaign, and there are some maybe not verbatim similarities, but the structure and the tone and some of it appears almost verbatim from the first letter. So the irony of, you know, please don't infringe our copyrights, but we're going to take someone else's letter to ask you not to do that is fairly rich.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly some egg on someone's face when it comes to this. And, you know, I, when I first heard this story about Silver Sun Pickups being angry at the Romney campaign, I guess I had a couple reactions. It's like, you know, Silver Sun Pickups, 2009, pretty cool. They're kind of a one hit wonder, probably fading out of, you know, the public spotlight now. And so this is a wonderful thing for them to get a little bit more attention over what appears to be a relatively insignificant use. It's not anything like Ronald Reagan channeling Bruce Springsteen a la 1984 or Jackson Brown being appropriated by John McCain in 2008. And there are several other examples like this. So, you know, the fact that there may have been some plagiarism in the letter goes right along with the overall perception that I had, and it was, of course, just my opinion here, that it was a little bit disingenuous of an effort to begin with at the first place sending this letter. So in my mind, I met it with a lot of skepticism, and, you know, any press is good press for the Silver Sun Pickups in this context. And, you know, fine. We certainly wouldn't be talking about Silver Sun Pickups if it weren't for this, and maybe it'll generate a few more sales on iTunes. It's a good tune. Panic Switch, nice beat. I liked the beat. So,
yeah, I dig the Silver Sun Pickups. Eric, do you think that campaigns are in sort of a thicket of difficulties? And, you know, obviously they have to present themselves in a marketable and pleasant way. You know, that's what they're all about, and music's a big part of that. Do they run the risk of ticking off those who are ideologically opposed to them?
Well, first of all, I'm shocked by Evan's cynicism about Silver Sun Pickups sending the letter. You think it was just a ploy to move records?
Oh, no. I was just trying to make some drama. They would never. Nobody would do that. No artist.
It's interesting. We've seen copyright issues arise in campaigns now pretty regularly for the last several election cycles. And I think they're just going to be par for the course going forward. We're going to see a variety of different types of copyright issues come up in the campaigns. One like this one where the artist feels like their artistic contribution was being claimed by someone who doesn't share their viewpoints. But I think the more interesting action is with the videos that are being posted online that are being taken down sometimes properly and many times improperly. What I find so interesting is that politicians get these firsthand experiences with overclaiming of copyrights, either when in this circumstance, Silver Sun Pickups may have nothing to complain about. Romney's campaign may have actually run a kosher campaign. But when they deal with it in the YouTube context and they have their videos taken down by bogus copyright claims, you'd think they become more sensitive to the fact that copyright can be misused. And yet, the moment that these politicians are in office or in positions of power, the first thing they say is, entertainment industry, tell me what to do and how much money you're going to give me.
John, do you believe that, or do you think that things are getting a little bit more savvy in your neck of the woods?
Well, I think they are getting a little bit more savvy. At my organization's annual meeting, which wrapped up at the end of July in Salt Lake City, we had a presentation on what top-level domain name changes mean for you. As policymakers. And there were a number of questions about, you know, what having the .smith, .utah, .alec names might mean for policymakers in their daily lives. So I do think there is an increasing level of savviness and understanding among policymakers, particularly at the state level. State legislators are, in my opinion, much more of consumers of technology. It was hard to find a state legislator at our meeting without an iPad, a Galaxy Tab, or a smartphone on them and using them at their workstations or their tables. So I do think there's certainly a greater appreciation for the issues that Professor Goldman and Evan are highlighting, whether it's in the campaign or the official context. They're not experts yet, they're certainly getting there, and I think they're getting a much better understanding than we've seen, particularly over the last decade, whether at the national level or at the international level.
All right. Well, I do like this story as well as a lesson for politicians and musicians, a lesson for associates in law firms. And we'll go ahead and make Paterno our first MCLE passphrase for the show. If you're going to adopt another lawyer's tone or, ideas from your form file, do so judiciously and simply as inspiration. And the wholesale adoption that went on here was probably too much and results in a whole lot of scrutiny that associates just don't want. So, you know, be creative, but not on somebody else's former creativity. What were you going to say, Evan?
Just use a thesaurus. If they say it's abhorrent, you can say it's unconscionable.
Yes, exactly. All of this a bit unconscionable, but it does make for entertaining media. Let's move on and look at our rights of privacy next.
Denise, are you going to dance to that music?
I am. You just can't tell because it's flashing in front of the screen. Hulu, as you know, if you are a Hulu watcher at all, is trying to better the television delivery model by presenting ads that actually might mean something to their viewers. And sometimes they give viewers a little quiz. Would you like to see this kind of ad or this kind of ad? But apparently they've been going beyond that and giving information, so it is alleged, to their advertisers to improve that advertising experience. Now, some viewers, customers, clients of Hulu's don't believe they've signed on for this, or if they have technically signed on for it, don't believe they should be held to it. Eric, can you tell us a bit more about this?
The basic issue is a law that was passed back in the late 1980s, the Video Privacy Protection Act. And it was designed to solve a specific problem, which was the ability of third parties to find out what videos a person had rented from a video rental store. This came to light back when Judge Bork, I'm sorry, Robert Bork was being nominated to be a justice on the Supreme Court, and reporters went and accessed his video rental records. They didn't find anything good, although you could imagine that there would be good stuff in there. For example, if you have a staunchly conservative nominee and they've been out engaging in lots of porn rentals, that would just raise questions. And so Bork didn't have a problem with that, but all the other politicians realized how much of a problem that could be for them. So they passed a law saying that you can't the rent video rental records are not available for third parties to obtain, and it made a lot of sense back in the old days when there was a store and you had to go to the store and check things out, and there would be a log just like you would have at the library when you check out a physical book. That you could set some boundaries around who could access what videos were watched. In the online context, where we basically have this global digital server of lots of videos that are being streamed or downloaded by lots of people, it makes it a little bit harder to think about the idea that those logs of what people are watching are protected in the same way they would have been just by the sheer physical constraints of a video rental store and the pieces of paper or the dumb computers they had storing that information. So the question in this case is whether Hulu qualifies as the equivalent of a video rental store circa 1980s, and the court said it could. It very well may have performed that function, and therefore that meets the threshold consideration to allow the claim to go forward.
Do you agree with the court's decision?
I'm not sure. And as you know, I'm not shy about calling it strongly when I see it. I have a strong view on it. The law didn't really contemplate what we're doing today. And so we have a very classic technological mismatch between the statutory words and the common technological environment today. And I know what the results should be. This is not what the statutory drafters contemplated. But on the other hand, they didn't pick such narrow words to restrict the applicability to physical stores. So this is a close one, a tricky one. I do know, irrespective of whether this court got it right, there are going to be a lot of plaintiff lawyers who are very happy about this ruling, who are going to look for other companies that are in the business of providing access to videos and who are sharing some of that information as an ordinary part of their business. They're going to say, you know what, guys, you're just like that video store who is allowing Robert Bork's records to be accessed. I think there's going to be a ton of litigation. And in that sense, I think it's a disconcerting ruling.
Can Hulu and others route around that litigation somewhat by changing their terms of service?
So I think the answer is yes. And yet there remains a debate about that. So one possibility is that blanket consent from the consumer saying you are always free to share my records in the following ways would trump the statute. Some read the statute, however, think that it requires individual notice about specific items that have been checked out, at which point effectively you'd need item-by-item consent to make the disclosure.
If that's the case, then no, there isn't an easy fix in the terms of service. You'd have to have a very intrusive user interface that would constantly pop up. Hey, can I share this? Hey, can I share this? Hey, can I share this? And in the ambitions towards frictionless sharing, where a lot of websites think that it's good business for them to have their users blabbing about what their content they're consuming with no barriers or hurdles to doing so, then the item-by-item consent would actually be quite onerous and potentially problematic. That's why Netflix has been asking for a change to the statute, allowing them to clearly give blanket consent. I personally think they may already have it, but apparently they're not willing to roll the dice on that.
John, I know Alec takes a look at privacy issues and gets involved on that front. Have you and your organization looked at the Video Privacy Protection Act? And what do you think about what's going on with Hulu?
Well, regarding the Video Privacy Protection Act, we haven't looked at that specific law just yet. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that several of our members have read the stories, and several of our members use Hulu and Netflix and other online services, Amazon Prime, to name another. And so there is talk about it. And what we've traditionally felt here at our organization, and our work product is to develop model policies and laws for policymakers, primarily at the state level. Something that's been written in our DNA has been to appreciate the fact that technology, as Professor Goldman pointed out, can advance by leaps and bounds in a really short time. When the VPPA was enacted, the internet, as we know it today, was not even a dream. No one contemplated streaming, file sharing, sharing titles to social media, third-party marketing online. That just wasn't part of the conversation. And I think technology in this new case involving Hulu is really showing the tension. It's grinding against the policy and what consumers want and what the market wants are really grinding against each other. So I do think that in going forward, policymakers are going to look at this and see how it can be improved. There was recently an effort to try and update this law. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who coincidentally was the author of the original Video Privacy Protection Act, he tried to attach an amendment which would have relaxed these express written consent requirements somewhat to the cybersecurity bill. The bill was not did not ultimately pass. A version of the amendment did pass the House a few months ago by a vote of 303-117, I believe. So I do think there is an appreciation for these changes in technology and some of the issues you have with drafting law. And how do you anticipate, to borrow a phrase from a famous Washingtonian, the known unknown of technology in the future?
So, Evan, we've got this situation where consumers and possibly plaintiffs' lawyers are thinking it's a good thing that this act will apply and restrain streaming video entities like Amazon Prime and Hulu and Netflix from sharing information. And yet we've got this situation that they're trying to address where everybody hates ads. And, you know, we just got an in-house cable system here from our cable provider that finally links up all our cable boxes in the house and lets us watch recorded content on any of the cable boxes, which, hallelujah, you know, you can fast forward the ads, but that's not what they want you to do. They want you to actually, you know, welcome those things. Do you see any resolution to this tension?
Well, I think what that does for me is underscore how the problem that providers like Hulu faces under this 1988 statute aren't the same problems that caused the statute to be enacted in 1988 in the first place. That was, as Eric said early on in this discussion on this issue, this was really to protect the interests of the politicians who didn't want their own video viewing histories to be viewed by others in connection with, you know, political campaigns and all that stuff. Here, the interest at stake that Hulu wants to exploit is the data and the information, the viewing history of users, so that ads can be targeted to them, more effective advertising dollars can be spent. And so looking at it from a certain perspective, it's an entirely different dynamic, an entirely different set of issues and concerns here. And so that's why I find it, you've heard me say this many times before, Denise, how my presumptive position is to have quite a bit of disdain for class action lawsuits like this, which don't serve the public interest, but instead line the pockets of opportunistic plaintiffs' lawyers. So, you know, the impulse drawing that conclusion and entertaining that disdain is to point out how anachronistic this is, applying this 1988 statute to a modern day problem in a way that is putting a square peg in a round hole and all that stuff. But the response to that anachronism, in turn, should not be throwing this out and saying, hey, there should be frictionless sharing, and that's a great thing, so that there can be targeted advertising and we can all benefit and enjoy all the free stuff that there is on the internet. You know, oh, I don't want them to start charging for Facebook and all those urban legends that come up as from time to time. But in yet another perspective here, we have this old statute in place, but in a lot of ways, the privacy protections that we have in the form, certainly, of federal legislation aren't nearly enough. I mean, it's only a California statute that I'm aware of that protects the privacy of the books you check out from the library. You know, I don't practice in California, but I know that there's that California statute that protects the privacy of your reading list. There's no federal there's nothing in the federal laws that protect our browsing histories, what websites we go to, what web searches we conduct. Certainly nothing that protects our location data, in the hands of private companies. You know, yeah, there are privacy policies in terms of service and all those types of things, but there's no federal statute that says that your location data is secure. And then there's recent case law, just as recent as this past week, from the Sixth Circuit, that talks about how the GPS information or the information that your cell phone provider serves is not protected by any Fourth Amendment. So the point being, there's so many other areas where privacy protection is woefully lacking. This is just one situation where it's a weird application of an old law to new facts, and we should not be quick to throw it out, but instead carefully revisit this issue and similar issues and figure out what the real concerns are and evaluate whether there should be federal legislation to govern this or whether there's a more appropriate marketplace response or something else, but not get hung up on the weirdness of applying a 1988 statute to Hulu and Facebook and the interface there among. Is that a word?
There among. It now is.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, let's make that our second MCLE bass phrase of the show.
Finally, there was something good that came out of my diatribe. The word there among.
I think you have your title for this weekend law episode.
We'll work on it. I don't know that we could have the one word title, but if you come up with something pithy that involves there among, let me know. There's already anyway. What, Evan?
I mean, professor's already dropped a couple of them. Parameterizing, I loved that one. He was talking about parameterizing something, and then, you know, and then there's been a couple kosher dumb computers too. So, but anyway, we'll save this to the end of the discussion.
Thank you. I wanted to, before we moved off privacy, respond to some viewer mail concerning episode 173 when we had Nilay Patel on, as well as Matt McCary. Nilay had a fairly good rant against YouTube comments and how horrific they are, and was very welcoming toward Google's move to allow users to use their Google Plus profile when commenting on YouTube, on the assumption that, you know, if you are operating under your real name, you're bound to be more civil. And we had some discussion about whether that's necessarily the case or not. Let's see. It was Red Hourglass Web on Twitter. I didn't think I pushed back hard enough to Nile's embracing of Google's new strategy. He says, stipulated that YouTube is rife with ugly comments, stipulated that YouTube is a company, not a public utility, but it's an invalid assumption that anonymous equals trolling. There are very good reasons to post as anonymous there, as for online in general. He says, laughingly, I'm assuming this is a he, laughingly asking to use a real name does little, as it's just whatever a user has for Google profile information. He says, I have many Google accounts which don't all have my real name. And here on Twitter, of course, Red Hourglass Web, I haven't, you know, pushed beyond that to see if there's a real name associated with that account. But I think it's a valid point that anonymous doesn't equal trolling. And, you know, I love it when my guests go off on a rant. And so I let Nile do his thing quite happily. And, you know, I think that we are in a rough area there, that, you know, Google's got to try and take the steps that it thinks may improve things. And the other thing that, you know, we talked about during that episode is that it's not a forced change. It could be at some point, but as far as I know now, you have the option to be anonymous on YouTube or to use your Google Plus profile, and Google would probably like it if people, you know, adopted that profile across their platforms, but they're not pushing that now. Anybody have any follow-up thoughts on anonymity, trolling, and what identity you use on YouTube? How about you, Eric?
So I can get myself into trouble on this one because I really strongly support a company's decision about whether to require attribution from comments or to allow anonymous comments or whatever in between they choose. But if a company wants to set up a system that squelches anonymous commenting, I'm totally fine with that. I think it's really in the website's purview to decide what's going to be best for its community. I personally think that there are times when anonymous commenting undermines the community. And so it's not only logical that the website would push back, but would actually be welcomed by all the other participants in the community. So I tend to side really strongly on the side of the website provider in deciding that. And if they decide to freeze out anonymity, I'm okay with that. That's also predicated on the idea that I can go elsewhere if I want to make my comments. So as long as there's enough competition in the marketplace for people to have their say somewhere else, the fact that in one particular venue, the anonymous comments are shut down is actually quite all right with me.
John, does it make a difference here that the company in question is Google, and there is just so much information aggregated in that one hub?
I'm not sure. I think it is a matter of, you know, the company is perhaps experimenting with a new way to bring some civility to the commentary on some of its platforms that has been criticized by some users. And Google's mission is to serve the users, and it's trying this out as a way to address that issue. I think on a personal level, I think anonymous comments are fine. Lest we forget, the Federalist Papers, which advocated for the Constitution being adopted, was written anonymously by someone named Publius, who were likely Thomas Jefferson, John Jay, and John Madison. And something I would point out, because I work primarily at the state level, is this is an issue that could rear its ugly head, and something we may have to address in the legislative realm or on a future mm-hmm. episode of this show. Earlier this year, several members of the New York State Senate, and I believe the General Assembly as well, proposed a bill that would ban anonymous comments on websites. They were concerned about political criticism. And this bill was pretty roundly criticized by a number of conservative and libertarian professors, and also a number of liberal professors, as just blatantly unconstitutional and really flying in the face of common sense and the law. But I think it shows that the idea of comments and how to deal with them will be out there.
Evan, do you? I know your kids are pretty young, but do you give them any training in how to interact online when someone is anonymous versus when they appear to be using their own name? I mean, something that digital natives seem to need to know going forward.
Yeah, well, my kids are still kind of young. You know, my oldest one is 6, so just now kind of realizing the interactive nature of the web. And so that's certainly something I hope to inculcate into their thinking about these things as soon as it becomes appropriate and as they start doing these things. And part of that process of inculcation will be to, you know, recognize the unmistakable and undeniable and well-established benefits of online anonymity, and to differentiate the classes of situations in which it truly is unmistakable and whatever other adjectives I just used, from those situations where somebody is being trollish or abusive or some other acting in some way that's nefarious. Boy, this is an adjective salad. So, you know, the real issue with Google here is not the virtues of anonymous speech or the virtues of using one's real name. Well, actually, it is about the virtues of using one's real name here, because we've got to remember Eric Schmidt famously said about a year ago that Google Plus, for example, is not a social network. It's an identity service. Cash Hill wrote a piece on August 29th, 2011, where that was the headline. What's really at issue here is Google's interests and Google's efforts of building a platform that they can monetize. They can't monetize it effectively if they don't know who they are targeting their ads to and who they can particularize in terms of identity here. So there's plenty to be said about the good things of anonymous speech. There's plenty of things to be said about the way trollish behavior and abusive and thereby unlawful behavior should be regulated and prohibited and otherwise dealt with. But those questions of that are really a separate conversation than what's really going on in the context of Google, I believe. Very little overlap, if any.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on in a moment here to talk about how Gawker used linked as citations to get around a defamation claim. We're here with Professor Eric Goldman and John Stevenson and Evan Brown, and talking about all kinds of interesting issues in technology law. And we're able to do that because of our sponsor this week, ShareFile. You know, in business, we're constantly collaborating with clients and colleagues and sharing files like contracts and spreadsheets and presentations. Those files are getting bigger and bigger and more media rich, and it's essential that they are kept safe, secure, and under your control. That's why I recommend ShareFile by Citrix. It's the easy-to-use business solution that allows you to exchange files quickly and securely. Now, in my personal law practice, I have to move around a lot of big media files, be they video or presentations that get so loaded down with images that you can scarcely keep them on your computer, let alone push them through an email. ShareFile solves that problem for me beautifully because you can send files of any size without any bounce backs. You can control who has access to those files and levels of permission that they have. You can sync automatically so that you and your team will always have the most updated materials. And you can access ShareFile from anywhere, whether it's your laptop, your tablet, your smartphone, whether you're at home or at work or sitting on a beach somewhere. ShareFile is going to let you get at those files and get them where they're supposed to be. So I want you to try ShareFile with my special offer. If you sign up today, you'll receive a 30-day free trial. And you can get that by going to ShareFile.com, clicking on the radio microphone, and entering the promo code TWILL. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in the promo code TWILL. will, and let us know what you think. We think it's a great service and you're going to love it. Thanks so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, Eric. So we've got Gawker, and they have a case that you wrote about over on your blog that could have been a pretty bad defamation liability problem for them, but they figured out a way around it. How did they do that?
So the case involved a Gawker post about, Gizmodo post about a company that was trying to get some extra attention in conjunction with CES 2011. The company called Peep Technology was promising some pretty fantastic new offerings in the marketplace. And so the Gizmodo post was able to go back and take a look at some of the prior claims from Peep Technology and from the principal, a guy named Scott Redman, and show that those were also similarly overclaimed, and therefore, by extrapolation, the claims that were being made for the new rollouts were probably not very credible. As you know, blog posts can be anywhere from very well researched to incredibly casual and off the cuff. And on that spectrum between off the cuff and well researched, the Gizmodo post was certainly near the well researched side of things. There was a lot of citations to original source materials in the blog post saying, "Here's what we found. Go take a look at it if you want to." So Redman sued Gizmodo or Gawker, the parent company, for defamation and some other related claims. The court tossed out the claim from Redman because, among other things, Gizmodo had provided citations via hyperlink to the source material. And the court said by doing so, it allowed the statements in Gizmodo's piece to be treated more like the characterization of factual material, more like an opinion where the facts were the underlying source materials that people could investigate on their own. So the result is quite powerful and not perhaps counterintuitive, but something we might not have expected. By providing a well-researched piece with citations to source materials, Gizmodo/Gawker were able to avoid defamation liability.
So is there some practical takeaway here for bloggers?
Well, we're trying to figure out if other judges would agree with this opinion. And there's a procedural detail I just should note in interest of full disclosure. The court's opinion was designated unpublished, which is not uncommon for California appellate court opinions. The basic idea is the judge doesn't want to do an industrial grade opinion. So they write up an opinion to solve the problem on their desk, explain their thinking, but it's not designed to be a well-documented opinion. So in those cases, the judges document it as unpublished. However, there is a procedure to request that the court publish the opinion. I'm going to be working with a team of people to try and request that this opinion be published. If it is, it becomes citable by other courts, in which case it becomes part of our precedent, becomes part of the common law. And at that point, then, the lesson would be do things like what Gawker/Gizmodo did. When you are dealing with these fact-intensive questions, provide your sources, link to them, let people investigate them. That increases the chances that you won't be liable for it. So the takeaway, I think, is for bloggers, be careful of doing the off-the-cuff, casually written, breezy opinions when you're talking about things that might lead to defamation. If you're going to be in an area where there might be someone unhappy with what you say, do the citations, and then we hope we'll have an opinion that will provide some legal cover.
It doesn't seem like this opinion dealt with Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, but I see some parallels here, even though this is not a third party's content per se, because it's the sources that were at issue here, that is sort of in the same wheelhouse, do you think?
I hear where you're going. And the reason why Section 230 didn't apply is because Gizmodo originated its own article, and it was being sued for its own article. Even though, as you point out, they were simply relaying, in some cases, facts from some other source. But I just posted yesterday about a different case that said linking to defamatory content is covered by Section 230. And the cases actually go really well together. On the one hand, the Gizmodo case says you should be linking to third-party sources so that people can do their own investigation. And then the case I blogged yesterday says, if you link to third-party sources and they're defamatory, you're not liable for that defamation. So they actually, I think, fit together really nicely.
Evan, any thoughts on this? Section 230, anti-slap, or anything else, other adjectives you might want to throw into the mix?
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm all out of adjectives. I could only add seasoning. I mean, this goes more toward the defamation issues in the Gizmodo case. I mean, I think it's really important, as Professor Goldman's highlighting, you know, the links and the citations and all that has to do with it and how it helped Gizmodo win this anti-slap motion in this situation, which I guess puts it in the position of having the plaintiff pay attorney's fees, right? Isn't that generally how that procedure works under that California statute?
That's correct. It's not clear that Redmond will have the cash for it, but there will be an order requiring him to pay Gawker's legal fees.
Right. So, I mean, what a powerful tool that is in a situation like this. So, but I mean, in a lot of ways, this was a rather ordinary run-of-the-mill defamation opinion, wasn't it? With the court saying that there was some hyperbole and that it was the mere opinion of the authors and something like that. It wasn't the citations and the links that was the definitive point that the court's opinion turned on, right? I mean, there were plenty of other reasons to find that there was that the anti-slap motion should have been granted, right? I just want to make sure that we're not putting too much emphasis on the linking to create an impression in someone that if you link somewhere in your article, you're free from defamation. It could still be defamatory even if you're linking to your sources. That would be my area of inquiry and comment on all of this.
And Evan, I totally agree with that. But the opinion is not a get out of jail free card for people who are sloppy with their facts and their own opinion. But what the court did was basically shift the analysis and say where the article provided its own gloss on the underlying facts. The fact that the people could investigate the facts was helpful to concluding that it wasn't likely to be defamatory, and that supported the anti-slap motion. But you're right, there were other aspects of the case, too, that the court discussed to help conclude that the anti-slap motion should be granted. So you're right. I don't want to overstate the opinion, but it is an unusual opinion. We haven't seen anything quite like this. And in that sense, it's more interesting than your garden variety defamation opinion.
All right, so let's move on. The Apple versus Samsung trial is coming to a close, so let's talk quickly about patents. Not too much to say about the case, except that it is wrapping up. Some interesting tidbits have come out in court, including the fact that apparently Apple and Microsoft, this is reported by All Things D, and information that came out at the trial, the two parties have a cross-license agreement that covers some of the design patent issues in the case that's going forward right now. But said there's also anti-cloning provisions in the agreement between Apple and Microsoft so that they can't copy each other's products. I suppose that's interesting on a number of levels, especially given the stature of these two companies in the technology arena. I'm wondering if any antitrust investigators found that tidbit of information interesting. What do you think, Eric?
I have not tracked that case as close as I should. And in fact, we have a couple of professors here, Professor Colleen Chen, and in particular, Professor Brian Love, who have been quite active in the media on the case. So can I take a pass?
Absolutely. John, let's,
Where's that squirter? That super squirter. We got a super soaker.
Yeah, no, I'm prepared. I can fight back if anyone wants to gun me down for being ill-prepared.
That's right. We'll just make sure the water is nice and ice cold before we send it your way.
Water therein.
Yes. John, I'm wondering, you know, it's a little in the weeds to pay attention to the individual patent cases that are unfolding across the nation, but they're all sort of a sign of how the companies have loaded themselves up with various patents and unload them on each other in litigation. Is patent reform or the way the patent system functions on your radar over at ALEC?
It hasn't been as so much. Patent law is one of those features, fortunately, reserved for the Congress in Article One. Because I have responsibility for 50 states and mm-hmm. all federal issues that bleed into the states, I'm more than happy to let Congress take that one. but I do think, you know, in the court, in addition to helping, you know, legislators develop model policies to address the problems facing their states and their economies, one of my responsibilities is to also keep them up to date on issues happening in the world of communications and technology. And something that's been coming across my desk through articles and what our academic advisors and industry advisors have been telling us is that patent copyright laws probably are in need of some reforms, not so much technical, but broader reforms. We're spending an awful lot of time as a country and as businesses and as individuals litigating over patents. We're devoting an awful lot of time and energy that could be devoted to developing new products and services and new discoveries that could benefit everybody. So I think, you know, hearing about these types of agreements between competitors, you know, especially negotiated agreements, raise concerns, not just maybe just from a legal standpoint, but a greater policy standpoint. You know, what are we incentivizing? Are we incentivizing court fights? Or should we be incentivizing discoveries? And I'm not a patent law expert. I'm not an attorney. But my sense is that the patent system was designed to, it was originally conceived to encourage innovation, encourage discovery, and economic growth.
Evan, do you think it's ironic that Apple and Samsung are involved in this battle royale and it comes out that Apple and Microsoft have managed to shortcut such a thing or end run it through agreements?
Well, haven't there been situations in the past where we've seen parties license stuff where other parties have been more cavalier? I mean, I'm thinking Apple striking, although this is in the copyright universe, Apple striking deals before with the record labels before it launched iCloud service, whereas Amazon was much more renegade with licensing for the Amazon cloud service. I forget the names of what all these different services are called. So, I mean, we certainly see some companies and co-participants in the marketplace be more risk averse than others when it comes to appropriating others' intellectual property. So the pattern for this has existed before we've seen this. My biggest, you know, question that I would have with the Microsoft situation is this: does it implicate Star Wars somehow? Anti-cloning provision. I thought that was interesting, where, you know, it can resemble the technology, but there's a promise not to copy. I thought that was a kind of a strange nomenclature and a unique way of going about it. I guess in that space, when it comes to design patents and patented technology and trade dress and other things, there, you know, that's a used mechanism, the anti-cloning provisions. But it's certainly not customary. Something that's a bit unique.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk a bit about policy.
Hey, Denise.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Before we move on and talk a bit about policy.
I'm sorry, and I hope I'm okay doing this.
Yes,
I just want to mention that. This issue about patents as as John pointed out, isn't going away. It just keeps going on. And I did want to mention that we are having a conference here at Santa Clara University on November 16th to try and figure out what to do to solve the problems with software patents. We're coming in with a premise that software patents are a problem. We're not going to have a debate about that. And then we're going to try and come up with concrete solutions that might attack that those problems. So I just wanted you to know that at least in our corner of the world, we are still very keen on trying to figure out how we can fix the problems with patents, in particular software patents, even though Congress took a big whack at things with the America Invents Act.
That's great to know. We will definitely look forward to hearing more from you and your colleagues on what emerges from that. And that's definitely a policy issue in its own right. So let's talk a little bit more about policy. John, you've been paying attention over at ALEC and your folks there to municipal broadband. We've had the Google Fiber announcement. Why don't you bring us up to speed on the FCC's national broadband plan and what you're following in the various states?
Sure. Well, as probably a lot of listeners and watchers to the show know, one of the big things, you know, the nation needs and what we really need to get out there is much more high quality broadband to the Americans. And what the Obama administration has done in the last couple of years is develop something called the National Broadband Plan, which included a number of recommendations for regulatory reform, policy changes to really speed the deployment of broadband. Some of the recommendations included speeding regulatory approval for things like cell phone towers, identifying where critical needs are, identifying the uses for these technologies, clearing spectrum that's either lying fallow or being used in less efficient purposes to deploy high-speed mobile broadband services out there. The plan's architect was a gentleman named Blair Levin, who was, I believe, the FCC chief of staff for a while, and now he's a senior fellow at the Aspen Institute. And in conjunction with the National Broadband Plan, there have been a number of efforts underway led by Mr. Levin and some other actors. What Mr. Levin has been doing is really thinking big about what are the hurdles to getting broadband out to the far reaches of the country and to people who aren't currently using it. And one of his ideas that he helped spearhead was something called Gig U. In Mr. Levin's mind and in the course of his research, he's said there's a couple of problems. I believe that the term was there needs to be a psychology of abundance in the United States and a real broadband advantage. So to create that, he looked at what the hurdles are, and the big ones are cost to getting broadband out there. It's incredibly expensive for private sector providers to develop these one gigabit networks to lay the fiber. Recently, we've seen examples of where these high costs are playing out. Verizon Fios system, financial reports have shown that it's very expensive to build these systems. We've also seen a couple of municipalities that have tried to build municipal broadband systems. Managing them are extremely costly. One in Louisiana, LUS Fiber, a recent audit found that it was spending $45,000 per day to run a municipal fiber network. So what Gig U tries to do is to reduce the cost by using universities as broadband hubs to create the market, to create the demand and to use the infrastructure that's available there already to get high speed 1 gigabit per second broadband out there available and used by companies and individuals. This also, in it, I mentioned there were some private sector efforts. One private sector effort of note is Google Fiber, which is getting ready to launch. This is Google building its own fiber network in Kansas City, Kansas, and making it available to people using a variety of using a new cost structure. You know, they're building where there is clearly determined interest. So that they know there's investment there and that demand for it. What's also interesting about Google Fiber, and this is something I've been interested in following for my members, is the fact that the Google Fiber network, in that case, there was no special tax incentive or special investment fund that a lot of states and some government agencies have been using to build the network. Instead, what Google did was work with Kansas City, Kansas government to determine the regulatory hurdles, franchising rules, local regulatory requirements, office space needs, rights of way management. And they developed what a lot of observers view as a really good plan to really speed deployment, and I think really will really is something that legislators across the country are going to be watching. It'll be interesting to see if Google Fiber is a successful venture, because that could signal to other private sector providers and new companies that there is a business model that can work to getting super fast, reliable broadband out to the masses, so that there is what Blair Levin calls the psychology of abundance that leads us to new technologies, new uses for broadband that we just simply can't even dream about right now.
Eric, you live sort of in the hub of where high-speed internet is a necessary aspect of daily life. Are you seeing progress on these fronts, or, you know, when you drive through downtown San Francisco, you still can't get a signal with AT&T, and is that kind of the status of things?
I think we've done a great job at increasing the number of places where you can get some kind of internet connection. But the broader availability of broadband, I think, still has some upside left to it. And so I'm glad that there's people like John who are fighting that fight to make sure that we get rid of the regulatory hurdles that might be interfering with the deployment of broadband and try and get people to make those investments so that it's even more widely available.
Yep, we definitely appreciate your efforts. John, Evan, any thoughts?
Nothing other than a gigabit really is fast internet connection, isn't it? I mean, that's amazing how fast that compared to today's speeds, like where 10 megabits is pretty fast. That's pretty blazing.
Yeah, it is. Sizzling. Wish we had it here and we'd probably have nicer video for the show. Eric, let's wrap up with talking about who reads and who doesn't read and what can be enforced if you don't read. Something like a blanket release to use your video that you participated in. You blogged about a woman named Suhuri who was recorded breastfeeding for inclusion in an instructional video, but then the video was put to purposes that she didn't like much. Can you tell us what went on there?
It's a super interesting case, and it raises so many questions, not only about the law, but about technology. So as you mentioned, we've got a mother who consented to being video recorded breastfeeding. The idea is that this would be part of an instructional video that was going to be shown on the parents.com website and on cable TV. And one of her conditions was that her full name would not be attached to it. They could use her first name, but not her full name. And then she alleges that the video was posted to YouTube instead of just to the places that were agreed upon with her full name attached as opposed to just her first name. And then bad things happened once the video got to YouTube pornographers took the video, spliced her breastfeeding with videos of people who look like her engaging in sex, and then widely posted that video with her name attached to it, and her Google search results got cluttered up. On the one hand, this sounds like a really bad situation for the mother. This is not what she bargained for. She definitely is going to have questions follow her so long as her Google search results are cluttered. On the other hand, two things. One, she did sign a blanket release in the sense that she signed a release to the producers that said, you can do whatever you want with this. And she says there was an oral conversation that qualified that written piece of paper, and that she signed the written piece of paper in a procedurally unfair way. She was hustling out the door. She didn't have time to read it closely. She relied on the oral representations, but she still signed a blanket release saying she can, the producers could do whatever they want. And furthermore, even if the video had only been released to, say, the parents.com website with only her first name attached, there's nothing that would have stopped her being fully re-identified by lots of different people who would say, I know that woman. I can tell you her name. And the pornographers could have just as easily captured the video from parents.com, and they could have spliced it into the video that they were making anyway. So there's a problem with her stated goal. She wanted to be unidentifiable and not be have her video go in the wrong hands. And I don't think that was ever technologically available to her. And then we have the legal question. What are the effect of the release when she signed a piece of paper saying things that were inconsistent with her understanding? The court and the first cut bails her out and says, we got to know more about these oral promises. And those oral promises might have been enough to allow you to sue these producers for disrespecting your the promises to you. We'll see if that ends up being the result. But either way, even if she wins that legal question, I'm still baffled by how we could attribute the breach of those promises to the outcome. In other words, the outcome could have happened even if it had never gone on YouTube with only her first name attached to the video.
So, Evan, we talk a lot on the show about enforcing agreements that people did not read. What do you think about it in this context?
Well, I mean, we all know, or at least can be reasonably certain, that she probably didn't read the release. Even if she had, mm-hmm. she may or may not have understood what it says. And I bet you it's very likely that the person or entity who handed her the release didn't even know what it said. Because in my experience with releases, I've seen some of my clients sign, it's like nobody knew what the heck they were talking about when they negotiated this thing. So that's why I think it's important that the court didn't throw it out on a motion to dismiss stage so that we can actually get to some evidence and get to some facts to find out what the real agreement between the parties was. And when I say agreement, I mean what the understanding was both in that document and maybe outside of that document. We don't know yet whether there was an integration clause in that document that she signed, which is the part that says this is the entire agreement between the parties concerning its subject matter and all that stuff. So if that's not in there, it'll be much more easy for her to establish that the real understanding was something that's different than what's in all of this. But you're right, Denise. It goes back to the initial point and the initial problem of people not taking these things as seriously as they should, perhaps through no fault of their own. These things are complex. We're under time pressures, and you know we kind of rely on other people's good faith when we're entering into transactions with them, that they're not going to try to slip something in on us that's not what our understanding is. So there's plenty of examples, things we can point to talk about where it's problematic of people not reading what the agreements they're purporting to enter into, what the actual pieces of paper or the words on the screen before they click I accept say. Lots of examples.
John, are you concerned at all about the holding in this case of the fact that the case was permitted to go forward despite the fact that a blanket release was signed?
This is not a case I've been following, and it's not one I've had in my wheelhouse. That issues, and not one that I've had in my wheelhouse.
Okay, let me make the question a little broader, because something that comes up over and over again for us, and that I see as kind of a policy issue, is that, you know, this was an individual agreement between this woman and the people who made the videos, and there was an agreement that she was handed to sign, which she did. But so often we're out there on the web clicking yes, yes, yes to so much legalese that nobody really reads or understands. And I'm wondering if, from a policy standpoint, your organization thinks that's a problem and is paying attention to that at all.
That would actually be a question for our civil justice task force director who works on those issues. I'd be more than happy to check with her and have her on the show. But again, that's not one I've been focusing on.
All right. Thanks a lot. Evan, I'm going to let you do our tip of the week and tell us how a turncoat friend could potentially trump the Fourth Amendment.
Well, I guess the tip of the week would be one that we've iterated probably a dozen times on the show before, and it's such a cliche, and that is, you know, don't put anything on a social media platform that you wouldn't want used as evidence against you, whether that be in a lawsuit or in a criminal trial later. There was a case out of the District Court of New York. I think it was the Southern District of New York. It was in federal court somewhere. And the defendant had been arrested for gang-related activity. I think it was racketeering charges that he was facing here. And he moved to suppress some evidence that the feds had gotten about, from statements he had made on Facebook talking about past acts of violence. And he was threatening some other people saying things to rally loyalty for other gang members. And so he didn't. And by the way, the feds got this information from Facebook pursuant to a warrant. So he didn't challenge the sufficiency of the warrant or anything like that. But he challenged the probable cause that the feds had, the things that they did when they got the evidence to establish probable cause to get this warrant to send to Facebook. And what they did was they talked to an informant, somebody who had turned over, you know, their loyalty to the government and the prosecution, logged into that guy's account, the government's witness. Logged into his account. He was a friend with the defendant, and through the access to the defendant's Facebook profile achieved through the use of that friend's account, got this evidence that they then used to swear out a warrant that they took to the judge and sent it off to Facebook here. So he moved to suppress, saying that that activity of using the friend's account was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. The court said no. That was not a Fourth Amendment violation because, when you shared it with your friends and put it out there, even though your privacy settings didn't allow the public at large to see it, that did away with your legitimate expectation of privacy because you allowed other people to use it. The court compared it with situations where the cops have recorded a conversation over the telephone with two people where one party, the informant, has consented to the recording, but the defendant who they were going after didn't, and they said that that wasn't a Fourth Amendment violation. They compared it with that. So the tip of the week would be to, if you're involved in racketeering or doing anything that may suggest, that may provide evidence that you're doing that, just, you know, don't put it on Facebook. It's a good idea.
Eric, do you think this case has any sort of business model ramifications for Facebook? Is this something they should be dealing with in their terms of service? Have don't rat out your friends provisions, or do they just need to keep their hands off this kind of thing?
Facebook's in an awkward position because Facebook's been litigating the position that everything that is communicated between its users is private communications for purposes of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. So their starting point would be that the ECPA would apply to all of the conversations at issue here, and that would provide substantial restrictions on the ability of the government to get it. Now, even if that's the case, that doesn't really fix the fact that you can't stop your friends from disclosing what you share with them. So Facebook already is taking an aggressive and perhaps unsupportable pro-privacy position, but even that position wouldn't address this situation. You know, I think the in addition to the general tip of the week that Evan shared, I'd add one more tip of the week, which is beware of turncoat friends. You should be friends only with the people you really trust. And I'll give you one different data point. You may remember the case Finkel versus Facebook, which turned into Finkel versus Daubert. Dauber, I believe, which involved five high school friends who were all saying incredibly mean things about a sixth high school peer. And this private conversation was all fun and games until one of those five friends somehow leaked out the conversation and the lawsuits ensued. Those lawsuits would have never occurred if all five friends had agreed never to share that information and had kept their word. But one of the five turned on the other four, and then all of them wrote large checks to their lawyers.
Wow, that's an excellent additional data point, and thanks for adding to our tip of the week, because, you know, this is the kind of thing that we're all dealing with every day as we go about committing federal crimes and putting them on our Facebook statuses. All right. Well, our resource of the week is something, John, that hopefully the folks over on your civil justice side can take a look at and will enjoy, because it doesn't address the problem of the breastfeeding mom and the fact that she didn't read her particular blanket release. But hopefully it does address the fact that we're all out there clicking on things willy-nilly on the web without really knowing what they're saying. And this is a new service that's called, for lack of a better way to pronounce it, I'm going to call it TOSDR, which stands for Terms of Service Didn't Read. And it is from, the people from Unhosted, with a nod to Tossback over at EFF, which was a side-to-side comparison of Terms of Service. Something by Asa Raskin called Privacy Icons, and also Open Notice. And what TOSDR aims to do is give you some very easy data points for interpreting terms of service, and they also are going to rate them, both terms of service and privacy policies, from very good class A to very bad class E. So that you can, before you go ahead and click on something, go over to TOSDR and see, I'm about to join GitHub. Let's see exactly what its rating is. And it turns out that its rating is class B. And it goes through and tells you exactly why. It gives you thumbs up and thumbs down on various points that TOSDR has decided are important for people to know. For example, whether your personal information is used for limited purposes, whether the terms can be changed at any time, even without your notice, whether cookies are required, et cetera, et cetera. There are a whole bunch of things that it assesses in giving a rating. So I really like this service and what it's aiming to do, and it is our resource of the week. Evan, what do you think about it?
I'll tell you as soon as I get off of mute there. good. It's a great principle. There's nothing wrong, nothing bad in trying to make people more informed when they decide whether to accept the terms of service of a website. I'm skeptical it'll have much traction. You know, I hate saying that because it's a wonderful thing. It's innovative, creative, all that stuff. But, if there's even a further layer now put in between the user and the service that they're seeking to acquire, it's just, you know, that much less likely that they're going to, try to explore that layer, namely going over to TOSDR and figuring out whether or not reading the ratings, figuring all that out. So good idea, good in principle. Maybe someday we'll all be enlightened enough to utilize it. So let's just hope that day comes sooner rather than later.
Well, hopefully the sites that are getting good ratings will at least be aware of it and will want to promote it on their sites. So that will help get the word out about it. Eric, what do you think?
We've seen a lot of efforts to try and do this type of meta data about user agreements before. And like Evan, I'm skeptical that this is going to be a definitive solution. I think ultimately we would all benefit if we could get that kind of helpful guidance and sorting through the user agreements. Even I would appreciate that guidance, and I've drafted my share in my day. The hard part, and one of the reasons why I think so many of the efforts have failed in the past, is that it's often difficult to distill down a company's policies into a single letter grade. The company might be great on topic A and poor on topic B, and trying to synthesize all that into a single statement so that consumers can get the message clearly is really tricky, and something that has just bedeviled efforts like this in the past. So I'm a little worried that, if anything, the effort might end up misleading people if they think it's as easy as reducing company policies down to a single letter grade, when I just don't know I buy that premise.
Yeah, I agree that if you look at something and say, that's class B or C, that means there's something amiss there. At least that might prompt you to go and take a look and see what got thumbs down. And I don't know. I mean, you guys both sound skeptical that anybody will ever know about Toster. So let's just hope we can help get the word out. And it seems to me like a very worthwhile effort. John, any thoughts?
Yes, I'm in agreement with my fellow panelists that we've seen efforts like this before, and these are valiant efforts. But they have been complicated, particularly when you're putting on another layer to try and simplify. That's not simplification. It becomes redundancy and more confusing. I can remember back when in my previous life, I was a congressional staffer, and we had a bill called the Plain English Act, which sought to simplify the Federal Register and other important federal documents by writing them in plain English. Still not sure what that means. However, I will say that I do applaud technology companies and crowdsourcing efforts to try and simplify the terms of use, the terms of service, and ways of getting information out there. I think it's one of the bright spots of the technology sector that it's always innovating, always trying to improve. And I can say that for the legislators I've worked with, that is really something that's appreciated. And I think we'll get there. If we don't have a service that cleans things up, then this may create an incentive and put pressure on companies and providers to make their terms of service much simpler and how they engage with users much easier.
All right. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up the show, wind up the show. Professor Goldman, it is always great to see you. We're glad you didn't have to virtually soak us during the show. But we're glad you have those there at the ready, and I'm so sorry for all of your students who must endure that on a daily basis.
That's not the only reason you should feel sorry for them. But always a pleasure being on Twill. Thank you very much for asking and including me.
It's wonderful to see you again. And speaking of students, we are on the verge of losing our wonderful Franklin Graves, our intern for the summer, who is going to be going back to his second year of law school at Belmont in Tennessee. So thank you so much, Franklin. You've been so invaluable. I can't even begin to express it. And we really appreciate it. I'm sure you wish you could attend Professor Goldman's classes and get soaked. But we're glad that we're able to bring everybody together virtually here on the show. Evan, any farewell you'd like to say to Franklin?
Well, just that, Franklin. It's been awesome. You've been a wonderful help helping us organize things and getting guests. And I think, Denise, it's actually going to be more of a burden put back on you because, you know, when I see Franklin working so hard to arrange guests and stuff, I realize how hard you've been working all along. So unless I step up and start picking up some of the slack, that's going back on you. So it underscores how important Franklin has been to all this. And he's really set the bar high for any future interns who dare to step into that role in the future. So thank you, Franklin. Appreciate it.
Yes. We love you so much, and we're so glad that you joined us this summer. John, it was great to chat with you again. Thanks so much for joining us today.
thank you for having me, and special thank you to Franklin for putting me on the show, and Evan and Eric, it was wonderful speaking with you, and thank you very much for Denise.
It's great. Sure. And we'll continue to follow the good work over at ALEC.org. Folks can go check out much, much more at that site to learn everything that John's got his eyes on. It's quite a bit of stuff. For everything we discussed today, you can go on over to our twit.tv/twill page. There's pointers there to our delicious links, which are where we aggregate the stories for the show. Delicious.com/thisweekinlaw is the account there. You can tag things on Delicious, and we will definitely consider talking about them on the show. You can tag them for This Week in Law, or you can head on over to our Google Plus or Facebook pages and interact with us during the week as we're getting ready to put the show together. Let's see what else. You can email us. We'd love to hear from you in email. Evan is evan@twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. And you can also reach us on the Twitter, where I'm D Howell and Evan is Internet Cases. Evan, anything else on your mind before we go ahead and wrap?
I started a Twitter tag thing today. You know, Rick Clow, who's our friend, who's been on the show before, he's, you know, a partner at Google Ventures. He was moaning and groaning on Twitter this morning about having to do a manual firmware update for his printer. And I was thinking, oh, you know, isn't that just awful that he'd have to do that? And so it reminded me, you know, a couple episodes ago, you know, Will Wheaton was complaining about event spam and Google Plus. These are awful things. So yes. I would invite everybody to go onto Twitter and use the tag FWPOTY12, which stands for First World Problem of the Year 2012, and tell us, you know, what it is that's really bugging you. Is it a firmware upgrade on your printer? Because those things are really awful, you know. So that's what I want to plug.
Or for some of us on the show, maybe not Rick, and some of us watching, maybe that's just good fun. We were watching The Big Bang Theory last night here in the Howell House, and Sheldon had to repartition his drive and install Linux and was, you know, relishing the thought of spending the evening doing it, at which point my husband asked our son which character on the show he thought Mommy was most like, and I thought for sure I'd get a penny out of my boy, and he said, without blinking an eye, oh, Sheldon. Definitely Mommy's Sheldon.
So. Well, suit yourself. Yeah, that's good.
All right. So first world problems and all, we will sign off for the week. We hope to see you next time when we record live, which is every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC at twit.tv. And we'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care, everyone.